How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change from Marketplace is supported by Impax Asset Management.
I'm Molly Wood. You're listening to Marketplace Tech's special, How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change. A key theme of adaptation and resilience is actually decentralization. A sort of self-sufficiency, whether that self is a house, a business, or even a city. And when it comes to energy, it means moving off one big central grid and creating little islands of power in cities, neighborhoods, and individual homes. People are doing it with solar-powered backup systems, even microgrids, little localized power plants that generate, store, and distribute power. But the key to any of those systems is that storage part. And where do you store power? Batteries. Batteries, as it happens, are also the key to electrification of cars and buses and other systems that currently rely on fossil fuels. So lots and lots of money and research is going into building a better battery. Kristen Persson and Hard Sader are working on it. They're professors of material science and engineering at University of California, Berkeley. They're also married and both work on battery technology, sometimes together, sometimes in friendly competition. Sader told me the way to think about decentralization is sort of like personal computers.
If you're old enough, you remember mainframe computers, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the utilities today are the mainframe vendors, right? And they haven't quite realized that the future is in, you know, small distributed computing. And if you look at that parallel, right, in 30 years, distributed computing has completely obliterated any mainframe computing. Even supercomputer centers today, people think of a supercomputer, but it's essentially a set of distributed computers. And of course, the grid is going to do this on a much longer time scale, and there are regulatory hurdles, and utilities themselves probably stand in the way here. But this is the future of the grid, right? A sort of dynamic marketplace of electricity between a lot of small players.
So microgrids are like the iPhones of future power. They also rely on cobalt and nickel, both of which are limited resources and with some pretty sketchy mining practices attached to them. Oh, and they're unstable and they sometimes explode. But batteries are still really hard to improve on. Sader, for example, is working with a class of materials called disordered rock salts to fundamentally change the structure of lithium-ion batteries and the materials that make up the parts, called the cathode and the anode. That would change how the lithium flows within the battery and could increase its energy storage. But there's a lot more going on. Prepare to geek out a little.
This is really our only path forward to make, you know, 10 terawatt hour. If you listen to Elon Musk and his battery day, right, he sees the world in 2030 as generating 20 terawatt hour of battery capacity each year. To put that in perspective, that's probably about 40 times what we make today. So there is no way we can do that with today's materials. And after that, there are also other things we work on. Maybe Christine wants to talk a bit about things like multivalent technology, things that are even further out.
So I think what is useful from the battery community's perspective is that we don't work on just one possible avenue going forward. From a fundamental perspective, we don't really know what kind of hurdles are going to be in terms of manufacturing, in terms of cost, in terms of it's a huge problem trying to project what is going to be the battery materials in lithium-ion batteries or lithium metal batteries 15 years from now. Mm-hmm. So the community is working, I would say, on a diverse set of solutions with different time scales associated with them. So, for example, in the Joint Center for Energy Storage Research, which is centered in Chicago, in Argonne, we're collaborators, we are working on things that are even further away. For example, what if we could use calcium or magnesium multivalent ions that are shuttled between the anode and the cathode? So they are 2+, which means that if you can make that work, you can get double the capacity, so double the number of electrons for each ion that gets shuttled between them. So you sort of, there is an obvious gain there, theoretically, but there are many challenges in terms of stability of the different materials. So we are working on different kinds of materials, so figuring out how do we make these ions move in cathodes and anodes that normally wouldn't have worked.
If I may add one more quick thing. So people at Berkeley and LBNL are also working on complete solid state batteries, which is really a game changer. So today batteries contain a liquid electrolyte. It really is sort of like the old school electrolyte, right? You put two electrodes in a beaker of water and the water is your electrolyte. But the electrolyte in a lithium ion battery is actually the source of the flammability. And so people are now trying to make complete solid state batteries. So with no liquids around, and they could have potentially extremely high energy density, but they would also be, and this is important, really safe. You can gain in so many ways because you don't need all the auxiliary equipment, like to cool the batteries or to protect them if something goes wrong. And so there are sort of very multiple really important and exciting directions that the battery field is pushing in.
Right.
Maybe we should say safer. I've heard that there can be battery fires even with solid state batteries. It's just a rumor, but I've heard it.
Really? Whose lab would that have been in? I don't know. I have no idea.
I love the idea that you could be working on competing technologies too. Like, no.
Yeah, it's a friendly competition.
Oh, multivalent is the jam. Solid state is done.
Totally. They're all safe, and we're never going to have a battery fire ever again.
Never again. Kristin Persson and Hard Sader are both professors of material science and engineering at University of California, Berkeley. And if you got a little lost in all the science, the upshot is there are no simple answers to this technology, and it's going to take a while. But they told me this area of research is well-funded by both governments and companies, and there's plenty of interest in getting it right. Self-sufficiency is also a business opportunity. The startup Block Power created software to identify older buildings with inefficient heating and cooling, prime candidates to retrofit for more efficient, decentralized, or renewable fuel and energy systems. That might mean turning a building entirely electric, or building a microgrid to make its power system self-sufficient. Block Power works on commercial apartment buildings as well as single-family homes and public housing. It identifies the need and then works to train local construction crews to install the modern systems. The company operates in New York, Oakland, California, Milwaukee, and has plans to expand to many more cities. It's worked on 850 buildings in Brooklyn alone, and on a rainy day this fall in the Crown Heights neighborhood, a crew was installing an electric heat pump at the parsonage for Cornerstone Baptist Church. The building is nearly a century old.
Old school conduit, black pipe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's wow. What they used to use back in the day, black plate.
The house is brick. It's four stories tall, and it has a big turret in one corner.
This is the Cornerstone Parish House, and so every pastor of Cornerstone lives here. I'm the third pastor to live here.
That's Pastor Lawrence Aker. He's lived in the parsonage with his family for 20 years, and while the home is big and beautiful, it still relies on oil heat.
It takes a lot because in steel, just to get everything heated, and then once you get everything heated, you have to turn on some air just to balance out the heat.
That's right. They have to turn on the air conditioning in the dead of winter because the oil heat makes the home too warm. And he told producer Stephanie Hughes that all that inefficient heating and cooling adds up.
Tell me about your monthly bills.
Enormous. I think just the oil bill, I think, is about $30,000 a year.
That's a lot of money.
It is.
So that's just oil?
So that's oil. So that's why you can see why we're excited about this opportunity.
Block Power, the company in charge of the retrofitting, is run by founder Donnell Baird. He says retrofitting buildings like this one is a way to build more resilient cities.
So at the individual building level, the building is more comfortable. It saves money. It uses less fossil fuels. But at the neighborhood or borough level, the entire grid is like smarter and greener and more resilient. Instead of investing $1 billion in fossil fuel infrastructure, which is expensive and not resilient, we're investing in distributed solar battery electrification projects to make the Brooklyn grid more resistant.
Baird himself grew up in Brooklyn in a family without much money. They would turn on the oven to heat their apartment. So he understands the need and the money it will take to make these changes. And in many ways, the key to that whole thing is finance.
So we've built a recommendation engine that allows a user to type in a building's address and pull up a set of preliminary recommendations on what kind of sustainability equipment should go into their building. And so we use a mix of big data, machine learning, some fancy statistics, mechanical engineering. We've built out an algorithm that allows us to make those recommendations. And so that's the software component. It helps us and utility companies and governments and building owners to determine what kind of equipment makes sense in each and every building. And then it allows us to develop a financial model of what returns to an investor or a bank might look like if they decided to finance a particular clean energy project in a particular building.
Okay, so you have the data.
Mm-hmm.
Building owners can go and look up their address and say, oh, it would cost me this much. But then you also close the loop, right? You do the retrofitting yourself?
We finance and install and project manage the project. And so for a 10-unit apartment building in the Bronx, it may cost $500,000 to replace all of their fossil fuel heating and cooling and hot water with 100% renewable energy powered energy systems. They don't have that $500,000 laying around. So we finance it. We identify and train a local mom and pop construction company. We get them trained by the manufacturer of the equipment, and we project manage the installation of the equipment that we finance.
And then where does the financing come from on the back end?
We have to negotiate with banks. And so we have a partnership with an investment bank. The New York state government has a green bank, and they've loaned us $5 million to invest in clean energy projects. And we have a new partnership with Goldman Sachs, where we're borrowing $50 million to finance projects across New York City.
And then I wonder, I'm very curious about the kind of the financial instruments that are making, you know, investments in renewable energy, for example, possible. Like, is this an opportunity for investment banks to then say, we have these green investments, even if the returns are not huge over time or take a long time?
Absolutely. So we think that there is an opportunity to develop a new asset class, right? A new mm-hmm. financial asset, a structured financial product that allows investment banks and pension funds to invest in distributed clean energy technology across America, across the world, and create a new asset class that provides them, you know, 5 to 15% rates of returns, depending on what kind of investments they make. And it doesn't correlate with the stock market. So it's an interesting new kind of investment. The fact that machine learning, cloud computing, mobile computing, the cost of those technologies has declined dramatically. The cost of solar, the cost of smart green heating systems in urban buildings has declined. That allows us to create this new asset class where banks and pension funds can finance these assets.
Got it. But it seems to me that on its face, like a 12 to 15 year return timeline is long. These are very capital intensive build outs. The returns might not be huge. So I wonder, like, it sounds to me like you have a sort of a data and this asset class play that long term could really be impactful.
Yeah, you can think about it as a green infrastructure bond for urban clean energy, right? So the returns will be bond-like. They're not going to be like the stock market, but they'll be stable. You as an investor are financing a particular asset out there in the real world that's going to have some financial returns. And so it's a different kind of instrument, but it could be really huge. And if you're talking about introducing environmentally sustainable technologies to the real estate sector across the world, I mean, that's just a massive investment opportunity. And so we think it's going to be a great new asset class.
Which is a super cool business for you. Does it sometimes feel like something that governments could be doing?
Well, it actually comes from the government. So I was a senior staffer for the Obama campaign, the first one. And when we won, my assignment was to work with the coalition of labor union pension funds. The idea was, how could these pension funds use federal stimulus dollars to create like green municipal bonds? But we didn't have the technology that allowed us to pull it off. So really it is the decline in the cost of the software that we're using, as well as some significant advances in the heating equipment itself. We do hope that local municipal governments start to structure green infrastructure bonds for the Bronx or for Chicago or for Detroit.
Donnell Baird is the founder and CEO of the startup Block Power. We know that addressing climate change and investing in adaptation and resilience will take a lot of money. I believe I mentioned spending $180 billion a year earlier in the show. But increasingly, banks and financial institutions recognize the risks of not dealing with climate change and the opportunity for new financial tools and types of investment. Even Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said this fall that central bankers should consider climate change risk in assessing financial stability and even bank regulations. Hardly any part of the U.S. has not felt the climate changing. The hot days are hotter, the snowy days are snowier, the fire seasons are longer and more dangerous, the hurricanes, well, we ran out of names for them. That this extreme weather is happening at the same time as a pandemic that's upended so much about our life has shown a lot of people that the worst can happen. That things like climate changes or plagues aren't just history or forecasts or models or theories. They're part of life. It will take a massive investment to slow down global warming, but it will also take a massive investment to make cities and towns and homes and countries resilient to climate change. In some ways, as you just heard, that investment is already starting. And some of this is like boiling the proverbial frog. We might not even think of it explicitly as adaptation, but we know the weather's changing and we have to change with it. In that way, the first step is changing how we think. To think less about the seemingly unsolvable global scale problem and more about the solutions. That's how we adapt. That's how we survive. How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change, was edited by Michael Lipkin and produced by Stephanie Hughes. We also had production help from Jesus Alvarado and Rose Conlin. Scoring and engineering from Robin Edgar and Ben Holliday. Original music composed by Ben Holliday. I'm Molly Wood. This is APM.
How We Survive, Adapting to Climate Change from Marketplace is supported by Impax Asset Management, a specialist asset manager focused on the investment risks and opportunities arising from the transition to a more sustainable global economy. Impax helps investors be part of the solution on climate change and other global challenges, offering a diverse lineup of strategies that integrate environmental, social, and governance factors. Invest for impact with Impax. More at impaxam.com/invest.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.